Hello. Today, Kate and I are happy to be in conversation with long-term Lapidus member, Dr. Reinicke Langel, writer, researcher, and educator, whose work shows the power of writing the self as both a personal and scholarly practice. Reinicke's research spans grief, identity, and narrative, drawing on her own lived experience as well as her academic expertise. Her 2021 book on writing through bereavement, following the loss of her partner, Franz Myers, has been internationally recognized for its depth and compassion. She's currently exploring new terrains, from good divorces and vulnerable research to the joys of new love and the playful edges of autoethnography. Reinicke teaches at Athabasca University and The Hague University, and her workshops and writing invite us to reflect, reimagine, and restory our lives. So, very warm welcome, Reinicke.
Thank you so much. Yes, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Reinicke, your work blends the personal and the professional in such an open-hearted way. Could you start by telling us a little about how you came to this intersection of life, writing, grief, and scholarship?
Okay, well, the grief part really came, of course, because of the loss of my spouse 6.5 years ago. So Franz passed away. I'd just like to go to the open-hearted part of it because I was reflecting on that question and what I think happened a long time ago when I was always an open child and wanted to understand people. I remember a letter I wrote to my grandfather. I said, I want to love people and understand them. You know, that was my sort of life motto. So I started really young with that. But also early on, I also was really influenced by my father, who was really interested in psychology. He was actually a PhD in biochemistry. But he had this great interest in, well, every kind of topic and especially psychology. So when I was 15, he gave me a copy of Alice Miller's drama of The Gifted Child. And he said, read, we shall discuss. Yeah, so that was
Wow, what a gift.
what a gift. And I said, what's the premise? And he said, well, it's that unintentionally your mother and I have messed you up. And to get back to who you really are authentically, it's a journey because we all are growing up with programs. So that's my dad's, you know, influence. And my mom is just such a strong and creative person and optimistic person. So I think I blended the sort of introspective seeker side of my dad with the very strong and articulate mother who, you know, who raised us on her own in Canada with a stepfather too, but really raised us on her own after their divorce. So, yeah, that's the start of it. You know, that's the start of it. I think, you know, these things start in childhood. I think often our aptitudes, and I was always writing early. I published my little piece when I was 8 years old. Not to say that people can't start writing later in life, but so that was my start. So I think I've always had this openness and desire for that. So
Yeah, it comes through in the depth and breadth of your work. And I'm curious how you said you started writing at a very young age. Is there something unique about writing that allowed you to kind of express something not possible in other forms? Or do you use other kind of creative and artistic forms, or is there something special about writing?
You know, I think it's storytelling. There's a couple of things that I had to make sense of some things. I remember one of my first writing teachers at the University of Alberta, Faculty of Extension, Eunice Scarfe. She said, we often start writing because we lo lose a parent early in life, or we are exiled in some way. And I had a combination of things as an immigrant child. I immigrated to Canada just age 6 with the family, and then my parents split up. So I think I had to make sense of it. And in our family, whoever told the story that had power was in charge of their own lives and therefore had freedom. So it was such a powerful thing. The storytelling in the family really was powerful. And you could really negotiate for your own freedom in our family if you could articulate it. And so that's, I think, was deeply motivating.
That is so
It
inspiring. I love that. And it feeds into your current work, which is on good divorces in terms of relationships and relationship breakdown and navigating all of that through collaborative autoethnography. Quite the mouthful. I'm quite proud of myself. But
Yeah.
before we talk about the method itself, I'd love to hear what drew you to this topic and how you're rethinking cultural stories around separation, especially how we define success or failure in relationships.
Yeah, I think there's this, there is a stigma around divorce, obviously. And I felt it too as a child, my parents being divorced. On my father's side, my grandparents were also divorced, and my great grandparents were divorced. So it's a family project also. And trying to really make sense of that in positive ways, without sugarcoating it, without denying the pain that there is in separation. And I have my own experience because I was divorced after 12 years of marriage, to a wonderful man who's still a very dear friend, and he's the father of my children, my two girls, and we were able to divorce with such equanimity and kindness, and I have to say that I'm kind of grateful to him, like daily, still, after we divorced in 2009, actually. 2009, we divorced. So, the girls were quite young then. Sorry for the traffic noises here in the background, but
We can't hear them.
oh, good. Oh, good. Anyway, so I always wanted to write about divorce, partly because of the family history of it, but also because I had this unique experience and people would comment on it. And I heard sort of through family telling other people and friends telling other people how we had divorced that it had helped some other families as well. And so they thought, oh, you mean you can divorce and you can still like kind of easily share the kids back and forth without, oh, that's cool. Oh, interesting. So I think from that point of view, it was just worthwhile. But I also think you learn about yourself through divorce, even if the ex-partner stays negative in some way, that you can still learn so much about yourself through that process. It's a passage of rites, really, in life.
Yeah, and so I'm interested on what you've just said in terms of, how we learn so much through the process, in relation to collaborative autoethnography itself, and what you're noticing or learning both from your own lived experience, but also others as well that might inspire people working with writing for well-being, and even their writing practice.
Yeah, that's right. And the writing allows us to do that, that observing on the page. I remember Julie Bolton explaining this. She says, literally, you have words on the page. So you have this distance between your eyes, and the page is literally this reflective distance. And I think that's so important because we say things like David White talks about that, you commit things to paper that you can no longer retreat from, right? The truth is sort of reveals itself on the page. And once you've said it on the page, right, the shame of it can be reduced because you've said it, you've been able to put it on the page. You'll know this really well yourselves. And then you think, well, if I've said it and I'm still standing, the world hasn't shattered from me saying it on the page, then perhaps I'll be okay also.
Yeah,
Yeah,
there's.
that's really empowering. And I believe that idea of the page being a transformational space potentially, because what you said earlier about the power of storytelling and telling a story, I think what I've learned through reading some of your work is that it's also power in being able to retell a story in a new way or revise. And I think around the cultural narratives around divorce, that they maybe need some revision.
Yeah.
And the fact that we don't have to stay in a stuck story.
Yeah. Actually, one of the most powerful writing exercises that I teach all my students or get, facilitate the process is the four question inquiry method by Byron Katie called The Work. And I find it incredibly powerful. Like, so say you take a statement like, My relationship has been a failure. Say you take that statement, you're like very stressed about it. Our first question is, and you write it down, is it true my relationship is a failure? So let me take my marriage. I got married in 1996, so we had two girls. And at the time of my divorce, I could have written down, my relationship is a failure. And then the second question she asks is, can I absolutely know that it's true? And the moment you really meditate on that question, write it down, you're like, well, suddenly I see two daughters, a whole life that was built, all beautiful trips that we shared. And then the third question is, how do I react when I believe the thought my relationship is a failure? And I think about this marriage, or a situation of the moment that we parted, et cetera. And then I feel terrible and I feel pain in my body and all of that. And her fourth question is, who am I without the thought my marriage is a failure? And I see that moment and I see the children. And the turnaround is the fifth step in this. And it's really, my relationship was a success. Like my relationship with the father of my children was a complete success. And in fact, our letting go of each other for new lives, and he has a wonderful new partner, is only has benefited. I remember at one point, he said, I said something like, yeah, I guess I broke up the family, and he says, no. He says, you added to the family. You so
Wow.
also gave me turnarounds. So he also brought to compassion to even my residual ju self-judgments, and that's the power of language, because I do feel that my marriage to him was a success.
Incredible.
That's so beautifully explained, because I feel like you've very succinctly detailed how both the distancing of putting things on the page can help with perspective, but also that cathartic vent, the fact that you give yourself permission to own your feelings and thoughts, and then maybe stand back and look at them with more objectivity. And then the Byron Katie, sort of even without trying to bring in or contemplate other people's stories and perspectives, just by analyzing and taking ownership and empowering yourself to reframe your own story, is incredibly powerful.
And actually, some positive thoughts you think are positive thoughts are actually very destructive thoughts. Like, I wrote down, but I'm a good wife. I wrote down, I'm a good wife. And then I wrote down, is that true? And immediately the answer was no. I wasn't being a good wife, and it was so liberating for me to realize that in some ways I was not a good wife. So I didn't have to hold on to this identity of being a good girl, a good person, good woman. Like I, and that has come up more and more in my writing, also in my grief writing. Like I, my spouse Franz, who passed away 6.5 years ago, I had anger towards him about an unresolved issue we had. And I felt like I couldn't, at first I felt like, yeah, but that's not good to be angry at someone you've loved, like, and they're dead. They can't even defend themselves, And then I thought, yeah, but I am angry. And how can I really live fully if I don't look at the shadow of things? Like I'm not whole if I don't look at the shadow. And I developed a concept called identity maintenance, which is what we all try to do through story. We try to maintain that we're good, that we're acceptable, and all of that. And then in that sense, push away those darker elements. But I found it was a very liberating for me to say I loved him passionately and dearly, and I was angry, and that's something that I can look at now with a lot more compassion, because I accepted my own anger. I had to accept that I was also angry at someone I loved dearly.
You've talked about how we feel things in the body, and of course we feel when things are and are not congruent. So I can imagine that. I mean, I speak for myself, but if you decide to change the nature of a relationship, from a sort of marriage or sexual partnership to friendship, that you can in effect be a better friend than you could, sort of denying parts of ourselves and pretending to be something else. And also that authenticity when we can own to ourselves our negatives. And I'm sort of thinking about the idea of the vulnerable researcher, your upcoming special issue,
Yeah.
and you describing research as me search. I mean, sometimes this kind of research is sort of misunderstood as narcissistic when actually it's so brave, and it's only by owning all our parts of ourselves that, anyway. How do you feel vulnerability plays in your academic life and how it serves others?
Well, it's such an vital, important thing. I actually had a colleague recently who gave a research talk on a really difficult mental time he had. Like he had, you could say, kind of a breakdown. And he said, I never would have been able to speak like I'm speaking now. And he could talk about his whole childhood as well, which he never had been able to do before as a researcher. And he wasn't in psychology. That's not his area. And I just think it's so liberating, right? Like, I was working 6 weeks after Franz died. How could I work 6 weeks after his death when I was even tr had trouble sleeping still? How could I keep my mental balance unless I had those tools, you know, to accept my humanity, my experience fully, and to be able to reflect on it? So I think it's for our well-being, it's just such an incredibly vital resource. And, you know, it's not narcissistic in a way. The most selfless thing we can do is invest in our self-knowledge because, you know, if we don't, we become a real pain for other people. Real pain if we are unconscious. So conscious, this is all consciousness work. And it can help liberate us. Like, how was it for me to do all that work and then see my first husband, Keith, come to the door to pick up the kids and me not be projecting on him? And all I saw was this dear man who was picking up the children and being kind to me, you know. And I had started a new relationship with Franz, so he had to deal with that, you know. And here he was, so gracious. And I had done my work in not projecting or blaming him indirectly for some of my choices, you know. So that made everything so beautiful, and it's been a gift to the children too, right? To know that you don't have to be at each other projecting or blaming each other. And he did his own inner work. He actually did the Byron Katie questions on audio. He liked more of the listening to it that way. And yeah, has a unique view because he's also always been doing his inner work. You know, he was studying Buddhism early on and reading the Upanishads and all of that when he was in his 20s. So he had a foundation for self-reflection that didn't come through writing because he's a painter, but it, you know, is still so powerful to do that. We did our work, therefore we weren't at each other's throats.
And just briefly to kind of pick up on the academic aspect of that, have you found that to be a fairly straightforward way into your academic writing, or has that vulnerability and that idea of me search, is it seen as research in a serious way? I know it is. I'm almost asking rhetorically, but I wonder sometimes about the tension between, proper research versus, me search, which I would argue leads to more knowledge, but just wondered about that tension.
You know, I think that I would, I think I'm working at a good time. Like, there's more, you know, even our awareness of mental health and all of that. So it's a good time to be working in this area. That's one thing. So just more from a sociological perspective, but I think I do have such inner courage and conviction that I think that helps. Like, I don't have when people say, yeah, but isn't that narcissistic? And then I can say, oh yeah, you know, I can understand how you would think that way, but actually look at this. And then so I feel like I can articulate it. And I also see that colleagues respond well. They say, thank you for talking about that.
Wonderful.
We don't talk about stuff like that enough at work. Thank you for bringing that to the fore. Like, I've been thinking that too, but, you know, I wouldn't say it necessarily, right? So, yeah, I sometimes joke, I'm the counselor Troy on the Enterprise, you know. We all have our particular role at the university. Right. There's the
Yeah.
Spocks and the Captain Kirks, and then there's the House for Toys. And so,
Your
yeah.
work really embraces complexity and lived experience. And I feel like even though it might not be explicitly stated, that inclusivity is a thread that runs through your work and embracing being inclusive of ourselves, so that we are including all of ourselves and also of others. And I'm wondering how your approach helps hold space for people with different lived experiences.
Yeah, I think it's almost a spiritual question, and that's another thing that in academia we hardly ever speak about. But I see it this way: every person is part of this great one light that we. This is how I feel energetically about it. So every person is so dear. So I want to go beyond labels like this person neurodivergent or this person is part of the LGBTQ community or whatever. I don't even want to go to that level. I want to look at everyone as divine. So when I'm working with a student, I'm not so much like, okay, well, they're this group or they're, they have a female partner, she has a female partner. I don't look at it that way. I look at it like this is a divine being who's coming to do their work. That's what I see.
Thank you.
That's inclusivity at it from the heart, or as you say, a spiritual at on a spiritual level. So you've written about grief, divorce, academic vulnerability, and now you have a professional love story
Yeah, I
that
do.
you. I wonder if you could just tell us, if you care to tell us a little bit about that.
Well, last year I was at the Dialogical Self Conference 2004. That was 2004. I gave a keynote on the vulnerable researcher, on the topic of vulnerable research. And on the conference program, I saw the names of some of my American colleagues who are working in DST as well. And out of the three names that Franz would continually mention, two of them I hadn't met yet. So I introduced myself to one of them from Salt Lake City. And then on the conference program, I saw the name Bob Fecho. So I thought, oh yeah, that's that fellow that Franz used to mention on DST. Oh, okay, well, I'll go to his presentation because I know the name, And then after the presentation, I went down the stairs to just introduce myself, thank the students that were there presenting first. And then I went over and I said, hi, are you Bob Fecho? And he said, no, I'm actually Bob Fecho. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, Franz used to speak about you. Do you know Franz Meyer that, from the DST community? Do you know that he passed away 6 years ago? And he said, oh, yes, I heard that. And I said, yeah, he was my work and life partner. And he said, oh, gosh, he said, it looks like you need a hug. And he leaned
Oh.
forward and hugged me. He said it was very unusual for me to do so. He said, I'm actually, he's a real introvert. And he said, anyone who knows me would know that's highly unusual for me. So we had a lovely, lighthearted connection, chatted a little bit more during the conference, and then later started a correspondence. Well, two writers who are both very articulate and love a humor are spontaneous or artistic. He's not only an academic doing teacher research and doing guiding PhD students, but he's also writing a detective novel. So we started this correspondence, and of course our correspondence is well, we choose our words carefully, so it's evocative. I think we think maybe we're just in love and maybe it's not as evocative as we think, but we're willing to test that out. So yeah, so we put together the correspondence with an introduction, and we still have to edit it down because it's too many pages. But it's lots of fun, and it's two nerdy professors who love language and love laughter and love to dance and have music and art. This is all Bob's art here, his photography behind me.
Wow.
Yeah, and he plays guitar and sings, and he's just retired from Columbia University in New York. So incredibly well matched, and it was very fortuitous meeting, and it was not something either of us were looking for. It just happened very naturally.
Oh, thank you for sharing that joyful story. And it's almost like Franz is the connector in some way as well.
He was, which is really wonderful and quite incredible, actually. Yeah, I feel the blessing of that. Yeah.
And perhaps through publishing the correspondence, it gives a glimpse into a budding relationship. I look forward to it coming out and to reading it.
Yeah,
And
thank
I gather from talking to you that there's probably, lots of conversation there, beyond just a budding relationship, an intellectual
Oh
relationship.
yes, exactly. Yeah, we're working on the Vulnerable Researcher special issue. Bob and I are he's leading editor on that series. And that came out of the DST keynote. He's also co-editing the divorce book with me and another editor. Three of us are editing that book. And then we're working on this project together. So we have lots of work that we're doing together, and we're presenting at the National Council of Teachers and Education in Denver later this year. And we're presenting at a grief conference together on divorces and autoethnography. So yeah.
Speaking of that, are you able to briefly, without, having to go into how collaborative autoethnography works, or maybe give Lapidus members a sense of what that how that research is conducted?
Oh, okay. Well, let me first define autoethnography for those who find it kind of confusing, and it's a kind of a big word. Auto, of course, is the self, and ethno is culture, and graphy is the writing, right? So really it's combining yourself, culture, and writing. So for instance, when we're writing about divorce, not only I will speak about my experience of divorcing, but I'll also look at the research done on divorcing. Like I might look at John Gottman's work, and he says, these are the four horsemen of the apocalypse in relationships: contempt, criticism, right? Stonewalling. He talks about those. And how did that factor in to the relationship, or is that what we're seeing? Also, statistics on, divorce in the United States. What are the numbers for first divorces, second divorces, that type of thing? So you do that type of research incorporated with your own story, and in written form. Now, at collaborative, I have not co-written. I've co-edited my own chapter on an autoethnographic chapter, but which was a really interesting experience too, actually, with John Sayers, who's also a Lapidus member. Yeah, I work closely with him on a couple of different, have worked closely with him on a couple of different projects, including a chapter called Professor Out of a Suitcase, which was my was what yeah which was a chapter I wrote about my journeying, becoming an empty nester, working in academia, spirituality. It was published last year. Yeah, last year.
I saw you present that at Vicky's Canterbury conference.
Oh
I
yeah.
was there. We didn't meet, but it was a really interesting look at moving into midlife.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's been a theme because as my girls have just grown up. But so anyway, so the idea of autoethnography is to combine those things in meaningful ways. And what I love about it is it makes your own personal story. It gives you that. It strengthens your story because you really are reflecting on it too. It's not just expressive, but it's reflective as well. And those two things come together. And I think that's so powerful in our self writing the self work. Because I did that too with my grief. So I would study grief, read scholarship on grief while I was grieving, writing about my story, but reflecting on it with the grief literature. And it, so that becomes actual, became a text. It's a textbook. It's a Routledge textbook that I use in my courses as well for graduate level education.
Thanks for that explanation. So speaking of your students, I was reading about the Brio Project, becoming a researcher from the inside out, where you invite students to do just that. What have you learned about guiding others in that kind of very personal kind of inquiry?
So these are students between age 20 and 24 generally, varying a little bit, but that's about the average age. So they're bachelor students at The Hague University, and we did an 8-week course, 4 sessions in person, 4 sessions online, where we did a whole bunch of writing the self exercises to get them to start reflecting on what their real interests and research questions are. So, for instance, they were in the human resource management program. So, say they're thinking, okay, well, we should study burnout, say, for instance. So they're like, yeah, that's an important topic, right? These days it's important, or women's rights at work or something. But then, as they start to really explore their family of origin themes, they start to write for reflection using proprioceptive writing. That's Tricia Metcalf, Tobin Simons' work of writing the mind alive, their resource. And then the students will start to say things like, oh, it's actually not just women's rights that I was so interested in. I'm interested in how mothers with young children are treated when they return to work and they have to, they start to get specific. Or in my culture, which is more traditional, I'm interested in how women are treated, and so they get more and more specific about the thing that they want to research. And interestingly, in the group that we had last run of this project, because it's an ongoing project, we had someone say, yeah, but I'm interested in politics, but I'm in HRM, but how does that connect? And looking at his background, he had a background of family history in the Baltic states, combining his interest in politics, his heritage in the Baltic states, plus the HRM. He started to see ways in which he might develop his work and his voice, and that he could combine all those things instead of saying, well, yeah, that political interest of mine, that's over here, whereas HRM is what I'm studying. And so to really put them together and see them as a whole. And one of the students in the takeout interviews, the outtake interview, said, I never knew what they meant when they said self-reflection. Now I understand what self-reflection actually is.
That's a really powerful feedback.
Yeah, there was really some great feedback. Even that the students felt they were treated like fully fledged, mature adults. They were treated respectfully. They were asked how they felt about how they, we did check-ins, and they're like, yeah, we felt like it really was an authentic asking how you are. And there's always laughter in those courses. There's always tears in those courses. A lot of things happen. And the peer support that they give each other in the safe space as part of reflecting on writing is a really important part of the dynamic as well.
I'm envious of your students. Although it does remind me of Alison's and my time at Metanoia, doing the MSc in the creative writing therapeutic purposes, which we loved. I just to circle back just for a second, because I realized that we didn't touch on when you were talking about the collaborative research and the good divorces. All the examples you've given so far are where there are children involved. And I was wondering, was that the main focus or?
No, actually, the divorce book, the authors that are writing for us, there's also a queer couple that's writing. There's also it's not everyone has children. Maybe most do have children, and the focuses are so different. Like one of our authors has a Christian fundamentalist background, is looking how that affected her view of herself as she divorced, right? Because of course it's taboo in that culture, and there's all sorts of rules around that and such. So each focus is a little different.
I'm interested to know what the drives would be in those cases, because it's not just pragmatic that we need to be sort of functioning and modeling healthy relationships as parent partners. There's something else that's keeping them invested in having a meaningful relationship.
And I think the growth that's possible, right? The post-traumatic growth, you might call it, right? That's the term. Can be so say you married, never had children. part, and you feel so devastated for 6 months. You feel like you have like a complicated grief even about it, but you discover that that actually has a lot to do with early parental relationships, or it has to do with the tendency to be codependent, and that's your particular kind of leaning or addiction or whatever, right? And these can be such important discoveries going forward, right? So, yeah.
Oh, it's such a rich conversation. I thought we could talk for hours. I'm interested to know, though, and especially because you've touched on with both current and previous partners that some of them are interested in the visual arts, and your focus is more writing. But when you're not writing or teaching, what nourishes you creatively, and what helps you keep your own voice alive, and to what extent other therapeutic arts, or just arts, or other things might inform and inspire that?
Okay, well, after this call, we're going to go walk over to the art museum here. Absolutely love art. Always go, every city I'm in, I go to the art museum. So I love that. We go to music and theater, all of that. And I also listen to a fair number of podcasts that inspire me. Like Elizabeth Gilbert, I'll listen to some of her work, and on she has some amazing talk in the Divine Feminine that I listened to recently. For instance, I listened to Martha Beck's work. You know, she's a coach originally from Harvard and talks about her alienation from both Harvard and her original religious background. Very interesting kind of identity conversations there. So I'll listen to those as part of my inspiration as well.
That's wonderful. And it's so important, isn't it, to keep feeding ourselves creatively, not just expending. So my personal last question to you is a two-parter. So if you could offer one encouragement or gentle nudge to someone starting out in writing for well-being, what would it be? And what might you have most wanted, and what do you think might be most prescient or most needed now, and whether that is the same or different?
Okay, well, the first advice I'd give, I think, is Jilly Bolton's advice. You can't do it wrong. You know, and what if you did write something like, you know, Anne Lamott says sh shitty first draft? Well, that's fine. It's no problem. No problem. Nothing happened. Nothing terrible happened, you know, or if you write a sentence that you think, no, that's not even true. Why am I even saying that? You know, then you found something out, right? So allow yourself, give yourself grace to begin, you know, always give yourself grace. And that's not condoning, that's not making excuses for yourself. That's just starting with the possibility of self-compassion. I want to say something about self-compassion because it's so important. You know, when we're hard on ourselves,
Yeah.
I say that's a reverse form of vanity. And it actually keeps us from growing. It slows us down, even though it looks virtuous.
There's a sort of self-defeating sort of exceptionalism there, where you're holding yourself to a higher standard than you are to others, do you mean?
That's right. Like, why would you do that? And it looks like you're being hard on yourself in such a, you know, a moral, sort of a moral high ground in some way or whatever. But why would you? Why would you? So I remember writing in a journal about, I think about 15 years ago, I think I was writing and then I was sort of weepy and writing schlock, you know. And then I did this dialogue exercise where I write between me and the cosmos, cosmos being wisdom to me. And then I said, yeah, but how about then? And then the cosmos responded, you know, this is just reverse vanity. And then I sort of something clicked and woke me up to it. I thought, ah, okay. So victimhood, entitlement, rescue, blame. I use that in my model, those verb things, VERB, you know, victimization, entitlement, rescue, blame. Those are all ways that we disempower ourselves. So grace is not just like a kindness, it's actually a requirement for learning.
Very true. And at the beginning of this conversation, we talked a lot about storying and restoring, and empowering ourselves to restory. So, is there a way that we can hold that without it feeling like an added self-judgment, maybe incorporating, as I did with my research, that's why I smiled when you mentioned Gottman, exploring it on an intrapersonal level in terms of our relationship with ourselves, in our dialogue and our own bodies, to get curious. So rather than it be like, why would you, it'd be like, ah, why would you?
Yes. Get curious with that little smile,
Yeah.
with that little smile of self-compassion. Just that little smile of like, what are you up to here?
Well, that's lovely. I have my next writing prompt now that I can reflect on what you're saying there about reverse vanity. That's a gift. Thank you.
Yeah, no, you're welcome. And I think, Kate, you asked too about what I would have liked starting out. You know, I think the struggle is part of it. So I don't know if I would have wanted any other thing at the start. I just am really glad their Lapidus community was there. I remember getting on an airplane and flying to the UK from Canada to go to Lapidus for a couple of days, and Lapidus members were kind of shocked. You came all the way from Canada for this? Yes, I did, because this community is, you know, it's really my soul kin doing what I do. It is, it's the people I don't have to explain what it is I do, in intent, at least, you know. Whereas in most of my other circles, it's what is it that you do, you know? And then nothing wrong with that. As David White says, it's actually, you know, you're into a good vocation when it takes more than a sentence to explain it. You know, there's a complexity to it, right? Yeah. So just having community is really important. And I've been, you know, I took writing courses in my 20s just for pleasure, and meeting other writers was incredibly important. And I think the important thing too is not to be competitive with one another. I remember a colleague of ours coming from Toronto and doing an assessment of one of our programs, and she said, you know, in Toronto, everyone's posturing like, oh, so and so just published such and so and such and so, and I was like in Alberta, and she goes, you guys are really different here. And I have to say, I was grateful, because if there's a colleague of ours who's publishing something, we were like, hey, look, she's, you know, Sherry D has published a new this, you know, or you're just glad, yeah.
Yeah, knowledge is not a finite pie. We don't have to be so protective of it. It's shareable.
No, knowledge and love, when shared, increases.
That's a
Indeed,
beautiful note.
no limitation.
Well, I think speaking of the Lapidus community, I'm just gonna thank you on behalf of them for giving us this generous time and your insights. I know it's going to be a great listen for Lapidus members and the community of writing for well-being. So, you know, very grateful for that. And you can find Reinecke on writingtheself.ca. That's right, isn't it?
Canadian website, yeah, .ca, yeah.
writingtheself.ca, and we'll make some of these links available of things that Reinecke has mentioned throughout the discussion. Was there anything else anyone wanted to add before we say goodbye?
You know, I would just recommend a couple of books, perhaps, that have really helped me in the process. I started off with, you know, Writing Down the Bones, Natalie Goldberg, of course, Bird by Bird, Anne Lamott, but also Gabor Maté, a Canadian-Hungarian physician who I had the great pleasure of hosting at my house once when he came to do a keynote. He's since become, you know, world-renowned, Gabor Maté. He's written The Myth of Normal is his latest book. But he wrote the book When the Body Says No. That was his original book. But The Myth of Normal and Sickness and Well Health in a Toxic Culture, and How Our Culture Contributes to Illness. And I think that helps in exploring grace as well, because see that we're a product of society, we're a product of our patterns and programs. And to get some understanding around that, to become trauma informed about yourself, you know. Of course, Bessel van der Kolk's book, The Body Keeps the Score, is a key resource. And one I have found a particularly inspiring for women, and there's a great TED or not, there's a great interview on YouTube with Elizabeth Gilbert and Martha Beck, and it's Martha Beck's book, The Way of Integrity. And it's not integrity in the sense of that moral integrity, but it's integrity of like, what are you doing in your life that creates structural integrity rather in your being, you know? And she uses the aircraft metaphor, you know, it takes a particular structure of the aircraft to get that lift happening. And are we living in, and I think, Kate, you said it well when you said congruent, you know, is it congruent? Are you congruent here, and here? You know, are you living in congruence with those things? Are you living in your truth? And she talks about that, and that book is very inspiring. She uses Dante's Inferno as, you know, she read it at 18 as self-help.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
I love the link you just made. Maybe it's just me, but for the first time, between sort of integrated and integrity, and then also more implied in what you're saying about that being the path to re resilience. That's really cool.
Amazing. Lots to go away and think about and reflect on from this conversation.
Yeah, well, thanks for the invitation. I really appreciate the conversation also. And I'm excited about the new generation of writing for well-being, people coming, you know, up. You can see the new names are coming and growing, and it's just wonderful to see. And I hope that people will also see me as a resource for their own development, and feel free to approach and such. So, yeah,
Well,
thank you.
thank you, Veronica. That's really, really, as I keep saying, generous. But it's as someone kind of new to the field, it's nice to have those of you who came before kind of lifting us up, as you say, not being competitive, but saying, come on in, join
Yeah,
us.
absolutely.
And I
Absolutely.
feel that from you. So thank you very much.
And so much rich advice and succinct but warm lived experience shared to inspire us all and to sort of to build on each other's work, as you say, rather than safeguarding it in a sort of narrow and more vulnerable,
Protective.
way. It's
Well,
so much.
enjoy your visit to the museum.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you
Okay.
so much.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.